originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Come again to beat
him. Hello again, everyone.
Raji Baraja Board crushing the field here.
Perfectly written by Javier Castellano.
Right here on the Horse Racing Radio
performance under Rafael Bejarano.
I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have given everything to the sport. Please visit the website if you are able to help. That's www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening won the Belmont Stakes with Colonial Affair in 1993, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies with Half Bridled in 2003, won multiple riding titles at major racetracks all around the country. She was inducted into the National Museum of Racing and Hall of Fame in 2000, and she was the first female jockey to accomplish all of those things, and one of the best riders, male or female, to ever swing a leg over the back of a horse. With 3,704 victories and over $90 million in earnings, it is an honor to introduce jockey Julie Crone. Julie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Christina.
So great to have you here, Julie. I have to tell you, you were, as I'm sure other girls, especially female jockeys around the country, you were my hero growing up, and I can't thank you enough for what you have done for us in a male-dominated sport. You kind of paved the pathway, and just want to thank you, Julie. I want to take that minute to show you my appreciation.
Well, it was my pleasure. I feel the same way when I run into Stevie Cawthon and stuff like that, so I understand, that's for sure.
Well, so tell us, Steve Cawthon, was he very instrumental in how you got started?
Pardon me?
How was Steve Cawthon instrumental in how you got started?
Well, he wasn't so much instrumental, but it was just the same statement. You said that inspiration was given from his success, and I was younger when I watched him win the Triple Crown, and there was just so many appealing qualities. One thing, he was really young. He was as adorable as could be. He had really a lovely way about him. You know, he was he talked kind about people, and he wasn't your typical egotistical kind of crazy athlete, you know, and so I just admired him from afar, and I feel like he inspired me, and I was kind of like, whoa, I want to be like Steve Cawthon. So just in along those terms is how he inspired me.
Well, and you grew up around horses, Julie, in Michigan, and tell us what you were like as a child.
I guess I was small and blonde. Something just a little more specific, like pitch and age range, like kind of, or...
Yeah, growing up, I mean, from what I hear, you were very young when you first started riding horses.
Yeah, my mom was really, really, really horse crazy, and it was basically the only thing I was ever allowed to do, so I guess I always made the best of it. It was funny, as I got older, I kind of looked back and I had a lot of different things I liked to do. Like, I played tennis and I ran cross country. And I was actually on a pretty straight path to be considered for the 81 Olympics for gymnastics as well. So I guess I enjoyed a lot of different sports and athletic endeavors. But the one thing that always seemed to be the most important was the horses, and my mom was into nowadays you almost call it like natural horsemanship or whatever, but she did things with horses that had to do with liberty. Like, have you ever seen the show where the horses, the white horses, like all run around and the guy communicates with them and they do all these, they go through their different things, they make circles and they rear and bow and lay down and do different, you know, designs as a horse group and stuff without any ropes on them and stuff. Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Like that? Yeah, well, that's kind of like what my mom did, and she was with a horse group and a dressage trainer that was a really famous dressage trainer in the 70s and 80s called Chuck Grant, and he wrote a couple books like on liberty for horses, like where horses do things. And so when I was really young, I realized that horses were capable of way more communication, and people were capable of doing things with horses way more than normal, like just not leading them around and stuff like that. And so I learned all those skills when I was really young, but I didn't think, I thought kind of like everyone did that, because the whole circle of people that did horses that I was around, almost everybody dabbled a little bit in some of the circus tricks and stuff, and those were the people I was around. So when I started to go to horse shows and stuff with my mom, when I got a little older, then I was kind of, I'd always be like, Mom, can't we just lead our horses around like other people? Like, you know what I mean? I had no idea that it was actually a big benefit for me to be way more educated in horse psychology and the way that horses communicate. And by the time I was probably like 12 or 13, I probably had, by then I was told by other people that I was already getting on people's horses and ponies to straighten them out, kind of like, or to help them, to help the people understand. Like, there's this one pony that used to run back to the barn all the time, and I helped the kid learn how to, like, control the pony, and, like, I was already giving riding lessons on very advanced horsemanship, just because of what I was exposed to when I was younger. So I got a very thorough education, and even to this day, it's kind of interesting for me, because there's this family called the Zerbinis, and there's a couple other Russian friends of theirs that do some of the Cossack riding and like the Grand Liberté and stuff like that. And there's this lady named Sylvia Zerbini, and she has these Arabian horses, and they come to Del Mar, and whenever she comes to Del Mar to do her big show, I get to go out and like be one of, it's a person wall, it's called. There's only two people, but it's in the whole entire big, it's like two people stopping 12 horses from going across a football field. So basically, the horses are better at receiving the messages from the people, so you don't need any ropes, and you only need two people to do the job of like 20. And it's a real big honor for me when Sylvia lets me join, like when she gets to Del Mar, she puts on a big show and we lead the horses around, and you have to let them go into the arena loose, and then all her 12 Arabians are, you know, making circles, and it's just a spectacular show. It's just absolutely amazing. And I'm always more drawn, it seems like I'm more drawn emotionally to those people. Even now, sometimes if somebody was to say, oh, do you want to go to the races? Or would you want to go see the Zerbinis? You know, and I'd be like, oh, I want to go see the Zerbinis, probably because it's where my life, where I started, you know, and what the horse, like, means to me, kind of like. And so then when I got to the racetrack, you can imagine carrying over that perception and that read on a horse to the racehorses, and because they're so raw and they're trained differently than other horses, so it was easy for me to read them and communicate with them. And I got lucky a lot of times doing things with horses that other people couldn't do because of my background and the things I learned when I was a kid.
Well, and tell us, Julie, when you did first arrive at the racetrack in that world, and it's a different world than maybe natural horsemanship and dressage and things like that. It's a world all on its own. So what was that like for you arriving on the scenes at the racetrack? Was it kind of a culture shock?
No, not at all. My mom and I had gotten books, and there was a couple racetracks by my house, and some of the husbands of the horse show moms had their racehorses. They had on the side, so the moms would go to like horse shows, and the dads would be like, oh, I don't want to do silly race. I want to do racehorse stuff. So they had fair tracks in Michigan, and I won like about probably like about 80 races at the fair tracks before I came to the big pair mutual tracks. And I was only 14 and 15. And then my mom actually forged my birth certificate at Churchill Downs because I'd already been riding races.
Wow.
And I galloped horses for Clarence P. Coo. So everything, it seems like I was prepared for it really thoroughly. You know what I mean? I was never thrown into anything. Because if you're a real horse person, you're not just going to say, oh, let me just go jump horses. You're going to say, oh, I better learn how to jump horses.
Yeah.
I better learn how to do barrel class. I better learn how to do trail class. So I had done barrels and trail, dressage. I had grand champion trail pony, and I was like, oh, my God, I must have been like 10, and the age group went from 6 to 18. And there was like, it took 2 days to run the class, so there's probably like 110 kids. And at that age, even, I was capable of, like, saddling and unsaddling a horse, ground tie, you know, drag a carcass, go by a tractor, open and shut a mailbox, put on a raincoat, take a garbage can with my pony, you know. And, but your horses are horses, and there's no culture shock if you're a true horseman. You can go to Japan, Hong Kong, Dubai, it doesn't matter where you're going, horses all speak the same language. It's just a silent communication of pressure and release and timing. So there wasn't really a culture shock. The only culture shock I had is that I felt sometimes that I was able to do things sometimes with horses or see something that other people didn't see just because I was taught to read a horse the proper way and the real way, like that where it mattered to the horse, kind of like. So other than learning about racetrack things and lingo and things like that, because my mom and I, we read the book The Shoe, and I read the book The Kid, and I learned, you know, like racetrack lingo a little bit and stuff from things like that. And other than just learning about the basics of being on the racetrack, one thing was funny. I had a mile racetrack up on my ceiling in my bedroom so I could learn the poles. And I think one of the first racetracks I ever breezed a horse, it was like a big racetrack, was at Tampa Bay Downs. And I broke off at the wrong pole because it was a mile and an eighth. Tampa was a mile and an eighth, and I'd been looking at a mile poles, which is kind of funny. So I counted backwards, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the poles. And I broke the horse off at the wrong pole, which the horse won anyway, thank goodness.
Well, that's all that counts, right?
Exactly.
You've mentioned your mother so many times, Julie. She sounds like she was so... She really wanted you to get involved in the racetrack, and that's not always
the case.
Well,
it was the only thing she allowed me to do, so that it's a blessing and a curse. So, you know, it might have been a blessing when it was happening, and later on in life when I was learning my own, taking my own routes and doing my own things, I realized, oh, wow, there's way more than... One time I was on a boat trip, and Sammy Bomitas Jr. and I were out fishing, and his dad was in the Hall of Fame, and he was a jockey. And he was paralyzed in a spill at Pimlico in, like, 1985 or 84 or something like that. And I was an apprentice jockey, and Kenny Black fell that day, too, and broke his collarbone. And I was there, and I got dazed. I got suspended for 7 days, and it was perfect timing. And everybody, his wife and everybody, was like, oh, my God, you two guys go fishing. You guys are going to have the best time, and Julie so needs this. And I remember being out on the boat, and the boat was popping along on the in the Everglades in Florida. And it was so gorgeous, and it was like, boo, doo, doo, and there was dolphins jumping and, you know, stuff, and the beautiful moon sunrise, and the moon was up still, and it was just such a special experience to me because I hadn't been away from home that much, and if I did, I was only working on the racetrack, and I never did anything else. And I was like, oh, my God, Sammy, this is as fun as racing. And Sammy was like, Julie, there's a lot of things as fun as racing. There's a lot of things as fun as racing. But it was, you know, she was very much only into the horses. But, you know, you can't, I don't have any regrets, that's for sure. I had a wonderful career and a cool life, but I grew into a very different person as I got older, and I realized I had other passions and stuff. Like right now I'm doing some art stuff, and I do props for theaters. My daughter just got the Ariel role at her school play, and I'm so happy because it's her first big lead role, and she's been doing theater for about 5 years now. She was Gretel when she was like 6, and so it's a pretty exciting time in our house. And then I'm doing props for a local community theater in Carlsbad and for the Addams Family. So I have a lot of fun, you know. And but yeah, it was she was very it was very important to her that I did the horses, you know. And I can't say that I was like brainwashed or anything, but there was a lot of encouragement on her part to do that. And so yeah, she was pretty important in my early forming of who I was as an athlete and a person.
Jockey Julie Crone is joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Julie, kind of give us a timeline. You started out at Tampa, and you won your first race at Tampa. And tell us where you went from there and why you decided to go there.
Why did I go to Tampa? I have no idea. Oh, I think my grandparents lived. Yeah, my grandparents lived there. Because I didn't have a car and any place to live, I lived with my grandparents, and then I got a job at Tampa Bay Downs walking around with my Fairtrack pitchers because I had pictures of me winning races on Appaloosas and quarter horses and Arabians, you know, breaking out of the starting gate and walking around with my pitchers just saying, hey, my name's Julie. I'm going to be a jockey. Here's my pictures from me riding at the racetrack. And I had a second and some other winners, and I had really cool. I was walking down the street, and I climbed the fence at Tampa Bay Downs because they don't let you in. So I climbed the fence, and I'm walking down the road, and Denise Pace came in, and she was like, she was driving by, and she was like, hey, what are you doing? And I was like, oh, I want to be a jockey. Here's my pictures. I'm like this. I've won races and stuff at Fairtracks. And she goes, oh, my husband helps one jockey every year, an apprentice. He loves to have an apprentice jockey in his barn. That's his thing he likes to do, and his name is Jerry Pace. And he was like, come on to the barn. We'll see what we're doing. We don't have an apprentice yet. And it was in January, I guess. And so I went to the barn, and he gave me a job, and I was galloping this little horse named Tiny Star, and she was supposed to be, like, really hard to gallop, and I had her galloping nice and slow and pretty and galloped all the way around the track, beautiful. And Davey Penna was there, the jockey Davey Penna.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh, wow, that was great, kiddo. You can really ride. I can tell that. I tried to gallop that filly the other day, and she's awful to ride. You're, like, really good. And he was so sweet and so encouraging. And so he's always been that kind of a person. And he was really helpful. And the jockeys at Tampa helped a lot. There was only, like, one or two that were, like, really mean to me or, like, you know, oh, I'm going to get her just because she's a girl. And all the other guys were really nice, mostly because of what David observed. He's like, wow, she can really ride. Why would I be mean to her? She's, like, a cool kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Jerry Pace was on the fence, and he got Jean St. Leon of the racing family, the St. Leons. And I guess the brother was a trainer, the dad was a jockey. You know, they've all been in racing, and he put me on my first winner, and that was the horse I breezed from the wrong pole, and he was like, well, he breezed from the wrong pole, and I was like, ah, and then that's when I learned, I was like, oh, but I thought that's five poles from the wire, so, I mean, that's four poles from the wire. He's like, yeah, but the track's a mile and an eighth, and I was like, ah, I was like, and then I learned where the wire was, obviously, before I raced, which was kind of funny. Little tiny details like that don't matter to people, I guess, if you're doing the horsemanship part of it, you know, they're like, oh, well, that's just the technical part, anybody can learn that. And then Jean St. Leon put me on my first winner, and it was a big, gigantic horse named Lord Farkle. And that was kind of exciting. And there was this girl named Julie Snellings that was paralyzed in a spill at Delaware. Her father was a jockey. And what did her sister do? Yeah. Anyway, she was a really good jockey, and she was paralyzed in a spill, and she used to tell me how to ride, and she'd be like, she'd call me in the jockey's room, and she'd go, oh, you should switch your stick left and, you know, do this and do that. And I'd be like, oh, my God, like, you're so bossy. And I went, and she goes, you come and see me in the racing office. So I went to the racing office at Tampa Bay Downs, and Julie Snellings helped me learn about how people take entries and, like, you know, that if you had friends in the racing office, they might say something like, oh, well, put the apprentice on the horse or something like that if they didn't have a jockey and little things like that. But I was really shocked when I said to her, I said, oh, well, you know so much about racing, why don't you ride anymore? Because she was always telling me how to ride, you know? And she rolled away from her desk, and she was in the wheelchair, and she was like, well, this would be one of the reasons. And I was like, ah! And it was really shocking, and I was kind of like, ah. But her and I got to be wonderful, close friends, and she helped me with so many things in my riding and friendship. And I didn't have an agent, obviously, when I was at Tampa Bay Downs, so she took me to, she had Chick Lang, Jr., and Chick Lang, Sr. was a general manager at Pimlico at the time. And Kenny Black was riding again, and Butch Eastman had just passed away in an accident in the Caribbean, but he was leading jockey, apprentice jockey in the nation. I guess right with Steve Coffin during that time frame. And then the next year, Kenny Black was there, and he was an apprentice. And Julie Snellings took me from Tampa Bay Downs to Maryland, and Chickie Lang took my book.
How did you like it when you arrived in Maryland?
It was challenging, and it was a little bit hard because people didn't really ride girl jockeys back then, so a lot of challenges.
It's funny to hear you say that, Julie. The last place I rode myself was in Maryland, and I found that they were very welcoming to any riders, apprentices,
women.
Well, it
wasn't 1983 or whatever, right?
Exactly, or 84. Exactly. And yeah. So what I'm saying is that
Rosie
I'm sure you...
had been there. Julie Crone had been there.
Yes.
You know, there was a lot of changes from people, too, more accepting of all things. The world was changing, for sure. That's cool to know. That's cool to know, and that must be a good relief to you guys to be able to walk around and not just have an assumption splatted on your helmets and be like, you can't ride just because you're a girl.
Exactly, and I think, again, part of that's definitely because of you is why they're so accepting.
And Rosie, too.
And Rosie too.
Rosie did some pretty good smashing up of stuff around to make people pay attention.
She did indeed. And Julie, when you would have a trainer telling you that basically they just wouldn't ride you because you were a girl, what would you do? How would that make you feel?
Well, the feeling thing is pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I don't know, I never was... I don't think I was like other people. I just think I had a really big heart, and I was able to withstand a lot of rejection for some reason. I don't know why. I just came like that. You know, it wasn't. It's just my personality, kind of like I'm persistent, and I have a lot of gutzpah, and that was not that hard for me. It was more like, the more they told me no, the more it kind of aggravated me and got me more jacked up, kind of. And it was kind of a funny journey, like storing all that up and using it later, you know, for good, like, and not having it make me, like, crazy or discouraged and stuff like that. So, you know, if you don't have that temperament or that personality... you know, and I'm not talking walking around for a month. I'm talking about walking around for like 4 months, like not having anything really that great happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a couple little dribbles of things. Julie Snellings had a horse named Barbary Pirate, and she owned him with her brother, and her brother trained horses the Woofendales. No, wait, her brother-in-law trained horses. Debbie, that's right. Julie's big sister was a horse trainer, and she married a horse trainer, and then they put me on a horse called Barbary Pirate, and he would bolt so bad hardly any of the other jockeys would ride him. And I rode him, and he won, but he was, like, way on the outside fence, but he still won, and he actually won two races. And I love the picture. Julie is rolling into the winner's circle in her wheelchair, and in the forefront of the picture is me doing, like, this celebration, like, hand up in the air kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really poignant picture for, like, all the different phases of racing and all the different things and how, you know, just getting to the winner's circle is so important to everyone in racing. And it's, you can have so much drive from a wheelchair to, like, a long shot on the outside rail. You know, it's still a winner, and it still causes tremendous joy, and it was the whole reason for everything. So moments like that, you know, definitely that someone believed in me and that I had to show everyone else was kind of like it would feed my life force and let me keep going out every morning. And then funny thing happened, Bud Delpa used to walk into his room. I saw every trainer every day, sometimes at two racetracks. I could get, everybody could say no to me and I'd be finished with my work by 9 o'clock. That's what I used to say. I used to go out and I'd be like, okay, it'd only take me like 40 minutes to have these six people say no to me. So I'd go out and be like, good morning, anything I could do? Good morning, anything I could do? And Bud Dell put his paper down one day and was like, yeah, I want you to shed row a horse for me. And I didn't even care if he wanted me to shed row. I was like, because he had spectacular bid in his barn at the time, and it was a pretty exciting thing to me. And then the very next day, his son was like, asked me in the office, and he sat me down, and he's like, hey, my dad's been watching you ride. And he says, when you're on a 50-to-1 shot, it's always fourth. And if you're looking like you could be fifth, you're fourth instead. And if you're looking like you could be fourth, you're third instead. He says you get run out of horses that are long shots, and my dad wants you to be his apprentice in his barn. And I was just sat there, like, I actually thought for a moment that he was joking me, and it was like a, because, you know, I'd been sent for the key to the quarter pole and a bucket of steam and, you know, other practical jokes, and I kind of thought for 1 second that he was joking me, like, and then he was like, no, but I'd have to be your agent. But I was living with the Langs, and I was paying $50 a month in rent and actually kind of reliving my childhood, playing in the neighborhood in the afternoons with all the other kids and, you know, hide-and-seek games and, like, cool, fun stuff in the suburbs because I was born, like, out in the country. And it was really fun because growing up, my life was a little different. It was more like gypsy-like kind of and not, you know, a family sitting down at a table and stuff like that. And I guess if you have one thing, you're always going to want the other. So I kind of wanted, it was kind of fun to be part of the Lang household and be with the kids and part of the family. And it was kind of a hard thing for me to be like, Chickie, but I didn't have any idea that Chick would be so happy for me. He was like ecstatic. He was like, oh my God, that's great. That's the best opportunity ever. And then, so then that's when my career started to really get a lot better. Because Bud Delp let me ride all the apprentice horses, and, you know, and I got to learn from Ronnie. And oh wait, I have one funny story from Tampa Bay Downs that I forgot that I loved.
Julie, let's come right back to that. We have to take this very short commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And Colonial Affair is putting in his run now. Sea Hero has dropped well behind. Now as the field turns for home, it's Cherokee Run driving on the lead. Colonial Affair appears there on the outside. And Colonial Affair and Julie Crone riding for her life now as they come down toward the final furlong here in the Belmont. Wild Gale is there, Kissing Chris with a late run on the extreme outside. And they're coming down to the wire. And Colonial Affair Julie Crone, the first woman to win the Belmont. She wins by two. Kissing Chris second and Wild Gale third.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Julie Crone. And Julie, that was, of course, the replay of your victory in 1993 at the Belmont with Colonial Affair. Want to pick your brain about that race and what you were feeling just hearing that replay just now. But first, before we went to break, you said you had a funny story to tell about Tampa.
Well, yeah, I was in Maryland and I'm talking about that, but then with the Delps. But then one of the funny things was Davey Penna one day, I kept blowing the turn at Tampa Bay Downs, which was odd because I had come from the fair tracks. And when I started at the meet, I was really good at, like, negotiating the turn and all that. But just, like, three horses in a row, it was just awful. It was just too wide and not riding. And I was in the jockey's room upstairs eating one day, and I kind of just had finished, and I put it aside and drank my orange juice and was thinking, oh, now I'm going to go take a little nap and then ride my two horses, and one in the first and one in the last, both 30-1, like I did every day, which was funny. And then he says, hey, come here, I want you to meet somebody. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, come here, I want you to meet somebody. You're really going to like them, and they could help your career and stuff like that. And I was like, well, okay. So he says, come on, they're not in the jock's room. We got to go outside. And I was like, okay. So we walked down the jockey stairs and across the paddock and then across the saddling area where you saddle the horses. And then we ducked under the fence to go onto the racetrack. And then we kept walking. And he walked me all the way to the inside rail. And he put my hand on it. He goes, here. He said, this is the inside rail. You want to try to stay as close to this as you possibly can. What a rip-roaring funny thing to do with an apprentice, right? Needless to say, it was just like one of the coolest things ever, and I never blew the turn again, and I became obsessed by staying close to the fence, and my riding really advanced a lot after that. But isn't that an adorable
That's
way to...
That's hilarious.
He's hilarious. He was such a wonderful character. What a beautiful person he was.
Oh.
Good athlete, too. So then when I was back in Maryland and Delp gave me the job and I started to ride the better horses and stuff. And one day I had seen another jockey, like, jack their stirrups up and stuff. So I made my stirrups shorter and I rode different. And a guy was like, you know, jack your stirrups up and I want you to ride this horse out of gate. And I had been known by then. I'd started to get a little bit of a reputation for being the person that got along with the nervous horses, the person that was smooth, the person, you know, utilizing all my horse education I'd had in the past, doing magical things with horses that no one else could do. But this guy, it got in my head, and he was like, ride like this. And I'll never forget the phone rang in the jockey's room in Delaware, and it was harder to do that stuff back then. You know, you actually had to call the racetrack, go to the switchboard, get the jockey's room, get the clerk of scales, tell the clerk of scales to get Julie Crone on the phone. And Bud called me and was like, what was that? He said, I don't ever want to see you do that again. So I was like, whoa. I was like, okay, we won't do that again. I was like, because the guy took me, you know, took the good things, that the qualities that I had, and tried to make me like everybody else kind of like or something. I don't know. Bud didn't like it. He was like, don't ever do that on my horses. And so isn't that a big compliment, though? That's such a cool thing to say to such a young person trying to evolve and, you know, be shaped into a jockey. And it was a kind of a backhanded compliment, but it made me feel good, and it really made me realize how much he watched my riding and cared about how I did and stuff, you know.
Well, and as you mentioned, just such a great opportunity that was.
Yeah, and I went
you.
From one great opportunity to the next, and it's cool that you did the Scotty Schoonhofer, the Colonial Affair, because the way I got to ride for Scotty Schoonhofer was I rode a horse. I was riding in the Meadowlands. And then I would go to New York and I'd ride anything I could all the time. I'd just go to New York and just lose all day long. Like, go back to the Meadowlands, win, win, win. Go back to New York, you know, ride all long shots, lose all day long. And like, but I didn't care because I was trying to get in there and I was trying to ride for people.
Right.
And Scotty Schoonhofer had this horse. He's like, this horse is, and I was breezing for Scotty too in the morning. I'm talking 15 horses a week and only riding like two of them, but I did not care. I'd leave the barn with a smile every day, come with jokes, you know, talk to everybody, wish everybody luck, watch the horses run, talk about a horse that I had just breezed for Jose Santos, you know, talk about how great it ran when Jose won on it, constantly just keeping my spirits up and constantly being the second in the barn, and I did not care. It was awesome just to be there because I knew eventually something was going to happen. And in the meantime, I was getting to know Alan Jerkins, you know, and all those guys, but you had to be there every day to get people to know you, and they have to see you on horses every day. And I learned a lot, too. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I didn't know everything by then. And so I was on this horse called Fun, and the horse was probably just like 40 to 1 or something. I went a three-horse photo beating Jose on his horse, a nose, and the whole next morning when I came back to the barn, every single person was just like, Fun, you know, all the everybody that worked for Scotty, and there's this old black groom that was there forever, and he was just like, he bet like $50 on the horse, and he was so happy. It was like the most elation. Like even now, I can feel the fun it was and the happiness, and you know, and there's no such thing as one shot deals. You know, like even if someone tells you, oh, even if you win on the horse, you don't get to ride it back. But then it opened the door, you know, by always staying positive and trying really hard and, you know, doing the theory of, you know, be third instead of fourth and, like, do what you can with what you have and always do your best. And once something is over, it's over. Leave it alone, you know. Start each day new and those little traits that make great athletes. But like I said, I'm not even kidding. That stuff was easy for me. Like, it was just my nature. I'm that kind of a person. So the game was kind of like I was designed for the game, kind of. It wasn't until I got hurt and had to overcome things that I felt like I was courageous or did anything that no one else did or was proud of myself, because the horses were always easy for me because I was so educated, and the nature of the game was easy for me because I was a little tough, you know, and I had something about me that was that I could apply the persistence. So Scotty, that was kind of a fun thing, you know, and that's how it started with that 40 to 1 shot. And then Jose had, and he got hurt. And then I got to ride all the horses in the barn. And then when he came back, we split the horses again. But that was the start of it, you know?
Well, and you rode Colonial Affair first out. Did you know Colonial Affair was that special?
Yeah, there's a funny story that I have told. In fact, I told it on a radio show the other day, and it's fun to have witnesses for stuff like this because people tell stories on the racetrack all the time. But Colonial Affair was really uncoordinated and really a backwards, mentally kind of a horse, and he was huge and really gangly. But when he was two, he got really fit really fast because he was kind of lighter. Because he was so tall, where the other horses might be massive and have baby fat on them, he was kind of lanky and tall right away, so it was really easy for him to get fit. And he got fit before he got his racing knowledge. Like, so it was hard to take him to the starting gates, like with the other babies, and have him learn, because he was always doing something stupid, and he was going to end up getting hurt, and he was rearing and biting, and he'd fall on his face, you know. He was just like, oh, he was just a mess. He was just a hot mess. He was just ridiculous. And we all decided as a group, we were talking about his personality, and I was, you know, it's kind of like, wow, what if we just put him in, like, run him? Like, he's going to just be the same. It doesn't matter. We're never going to teach him what he needs to know because it was his nature, how he was. And we said, let's just race him. You know, in 6 furlongs, he was just, like, lost, you know, but I wanted him to understand the science of the race, so broke him out of the gate and, like, trying to get him, he can't catch up at all, and then making sure he passes horses at the end, and then the next race he raced, making sure he passes horses at the end, and he really loved racing. It really was good for him, even though he was so young and he had stuff to learn. It was really way better for him than trying to gallop him and breeze him to the race. It just was a good fit for him, like some horses. And the second race after he ran, I'll never forget how he was standing there when he pulled up, and his eyes were, like, huge, and he, you know, he's panting, and all the other horses are kind of galloping back, and he's watching them, and he looked at the starting gate, and the tractor started to pull it, and he watched it pull away, And then he looked back at the grandstand, and he was almost like hoof to head, you know, like, poof, I get it. You know, he was kind of like, and then when we got him back to the barn, we all decided to put blinkers on him. And then I had to leave town. And he was training completely different. His light went on. He was so on. And we all knew he was going to win. Now he was ready. Like, he got it. The whole thing, the whole package came together for him. And Richie Migliori was my best friend and my best horse person at the time that I talked to about everything. So Scotty said, you have to go out of town to ride so-and-so. Who do you want to ride Colonial Affair when you're gone? And I was like, oh, my God, well, Richie, of course. I said, but you know he's going to win. And Scotty says, yeah, that's why you get Richie to ride him, so Richie knows that, you know, he won't be mad if you take him off, but you can tell him all your dorky little things about him. And because I was really particular about the horses, you know. You know, don't put your cross like this and trot him to this part and then canter him after that. And, you know, I was all dorky. And and so I told Richie, I went to the jocks room when Colonial Fair was two, and I said, hey, Richie, do you want to ride the horse that's going to win the Belmont next year? You can break his maiden because I'm going out of town and I don't trust anybody else with him but you. And Richie was like, yeah, can I ride him in the Belmont too? And I was like, God willing and the creeks don't rise. No. I was like, but to this day, it's one of the funnest things, like, to know so sure about a horse's development and his pedigree and, like, everything about him. And everything was just always pointed for the Belmont, even from when he was a two-year-old. So it was kind of an exciting journey with that particular horse.
Yeah, you called it early on. And tell us, Julie, describe the race. Of course, it was a bit of a sad day for Prairie Bayou, of course, but describe the race and what you were feeling turning for home.
Yeah, well, it's kind of cool. One of the first things, the day started with, if you could even believe this, talk about painting the perfect scenario, Steve Coffin was commentating that day.
Oh.
And to have him walk into the jockey's room and me know, oh, and then it rained, and Colonial Fair loved the slop, absolutely loved the wet track. So Colonial Fair was like, I was just waiting for the race to get over with so I could win the Belmont and get it over with, kind of like, that's how sure I was. His breeze, everything about him was so perfect for the day. Everything went so perfect. And Steve Cawthon came in the room, and I was like, oh, my God, yeah, you're the reason I'm a jockey. But he'd known that because I told him that by 10 times by then. And he graciously made the transition to, they were talking about Prairie Bayou breaking down, and then Steve made the most gracious transition. I'll never forget. He said, but that's a terrible tragedy of the day, and glad Mike Smith is okay, but let's not forget the joy Julie Crone must be feeling being, you know, a girl jockey and winning the Belmont for the first time, kind of a thing. So I always thought that was such a wonderful thing for him to say and was so true. But, Colonial Fair is a pretty neat athlete and a pretty cool dude that was in – out of all the races, I was never more sure of any horse winning, which was kind of a good feeling. But just kind of broke out of the starting gate, went to the rail, and we started to go up the backside, which everyone knows at Belmont lasts forever. And he was going along, and he started to get a little discouraged from the mud. Like, his face was, like, just globbed with mud. It was kind of like a in-between drying-ish kind of track. So I swung him out to the outside, and then he, like, really grabbed the bridle, and he was like, I'm ready. And I was just waiting for Prairie Bayou. And, in fact, if you ever watch the video, I keep looking behind me and I keep looking behind me because if Colonial Affair makes the lead too soon, he kind of would get disinterested. And he was, like, you know, obviously he's only a three-year-old and he had things anyway, so I was trying to be careful not to let him go to the lead too soon. But then when Prairie Bayou just wasn't showing up, I just turned him loose and went on my way. And I guess the rest is history.
The rest is history, Julie. Now, when you are turning for home, and usually, in my experience, riding, you don't really hear the crowd. You're so focused on riding and your animal and everything going on in the race. But could you hear the crowd and the crowd just jump up cheering when you cross the wire in front?
No. I remember that day was interesting because I never heard the crowd scream like that when you're in the starting gate. That was kind of an interesting thing. But I don't remember, today I don't remember that being like that. I just remember coming down the stretch and having it be just like anything else. Maybe the wind and the way it feels and stuff, you And when I galloped back, obviously, the crowd was, I could barely move into the sound, but I couldn't hear them.
Jockey Julie Crone joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Julie, let's jump ahead to Half Bridled in 2003, winning the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. Tell us about Half Bridled and that experience.
Oh, what a beautiful mare. Just gorgeous. Oh, I guess she's a filly because she was so young. Scotty, I had made a comeback from, it was after my retirement, and I'm in California for the very first time. Hold on, I'm catching my brain up to the story, but I'm kind of like, catch him in. So I retired, and then I came to California, and I start, I only went to Scotty's barn, basically, in the very beginning. I mean, Mandela's barn, in the very beginning, and he had a girl working for him called Becky Wiseman, and she was really good with horses, and she was really good at matching people and horses. And she was kind of like, Julie, you've got to get on this mare. She's so sensitive and has all these little things with her that like are quirky, and you'll probably really get along with her really well. And I was like, okay. So I got to start breezing her, and we just made a really good pair. And Mandela was like, oh, yeah, that's a good match. And started breezing her, and he's really fun to work for, Richard, because the horses are put on such an emotional program. Like, they... And they're also, it's a very thorough education. Like, they gallop together almost every day, the young horses, and you switch positions. And, like, you know, you'll go out one day and you'll gallop in the front with everybody at your boot. And then you'll gallop the next day behind. And then, you know, one day you'll gallop on the outside. And the next day you gallop on the inside. And all the breezes are super, super slow, but really very technical. Like, you break off and there's two in front and two in the back, and you know you're going to do like 52 for the half, but you go four abreast at the quarter pole and everybody finishes together. Or the two that are in front come off the fence and the two that are behind slide up into the spot on the rail, but you all finish head and head together. And then the next week when they breeze, you know, the half again in 52, the group that was in front goes to the back. So I shared all those breezes with Half Bridled. Like, I was part of her development emotionally and physically. And just from the very beginning, you know, like, we were all just amazed at the ease that she did everything with and how sensitive she was. And just, she's gigantic. And she wasn't at all, like, gangly or uncoordinated. She was so precocious and would buck. Oh, my dear Lord, that mare, a little filly could buck. She bucked so bad the day she broke her maiden going 5/8 at Del Mar. It was really funny. We galloped off, you know, you gallop from in front of the grandstand, and Richard's barn is on the front side. So she thought she knew the routine, and she was very bossy, and she was really like, you couldn't insult her ego. Like, you had to be really careful if you... If she didn't want to do something, you couldn't say, oh, yes, you are. You had to say, okay, well, like, you know, you don't have to do it. Maybe we can do it a different way. Like, let's go this way, or let's do it at the walk instead of the trot. How about that? Is that okay? And she'd be like, okay, I'll walk. She'd be like, so you would just walk her, and then all of a sudden she'd say, okay, now I'll trot. And you'd be like, okay, we'll take it. Like, nobody ever, like, manhandled her, or like, because she was really kind of had her own thoughts a lot, you know, and you didn't want to knock that out of her because that was part of her brilliance, kind of. So going to the starting gate, though, you don't have those luxuries, and so she had walked past the gap after this little tiny warm-up that was going back to her barn, and she was like, oh, she stood there at the gap, and then she looked, and there was a pole across, and I saw her kind of think, well, someone needs to move that pole so we can go back to the barn. And I was like, oh, no, she's thinking. And I was like, okay, to the pony girl, I said, I know this is going to be weird, but we have to go the opposite direction, because everybody else was almost lining up for the gate. I said, we have to go the opposite direction, and we have to trot her down on the rail, and then we have to canter her, like, right now, or this is going to go really wrong, or she's going to get really mad. So So we trotted her and then cantered her and turned her around. Well, the second she knew that I tricked her, she started bucking so bad, like boom, ba booshka, boom, ba boom, and kicking out in the back and leaping through the air. And then she did this huge blow, like, and then put her head down, and it was over. And then she went into her zone, her racing zone, and she was back, and there was everything was okay. But she was really a really beautiful, emotional, like just such a complex, cool little horse. And I really felt a real intense connection with her. So it was so much more of a pleasure and so much a big deal for me to share something with her, like the Breeders' Cup, you know. It was like two friends getting a big win together and something, kind of like me and Julie Snellings, and feeling her mature and keep her spirit. And it was a really fun race. And Richard is obviously one of the most incredible trainers ever. What a man, oh, Mandela, what a day is right that he had that day. So, and it was so funny. The other horse the other day, I picked the wrong horse, and David Flores won on the other horse of Mandela's that day, and I had breezed both of them, and I picked the wrong one. So, See, even after all that time, you still don't know everything.
That is true. That's a wonderful thing.
My horse finished up the track, and David Flores, thank God it was him, because he's the best guy in the world, and if anybody ever took a winner from me, I'd want it to be him. Him or Migliori, but yeah, that was a cool day for him. At least he got his Breeders' Cup winner. But yeah, isn't that something that I picked the wrong horse that day?
You know, like you said, you're always learning something in this sport, that's for sure. And yeah. Julie, I can't believe we only have 5 minutes left here. I think we could have a 3-hour talk show with you, but we've talked about Half Bridled and Colonial Affair, and of course you've ridden the likes of Candy Ride and Mr. Greeley, Light the Fuse.
Oh, Mr. Greeley, what a crazy boy, and Light the Fuse, great horse.
I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I can keep mentioning names here. Rubiano. But in your personal opinion, who's your favorite?
I don't like to pick.
You don't
like
to pick?
I like to do categories. I like to do turf horse, sprint horse, distance horse, turf mare. Like, there's no way, because you race in categories. You don't race in singular experiences,
sure.
You know? And even, like, I would have a hard time separating my turf horses, you know? Like, I rode Royal Mountain Inn, and I rode this crazy little adorable pure white horse called Grey Dude. And I think I must have won, like, 16 races on him or something. Like, he was, and you could not carry a whip when you rode him. This horse was so sensitive to the whip, you couldn't even lift your whip off his shoulder or even touch it on his shoulder if you carried it. So I just told the guy, I was like, oh, my God, I don't even want to carry a stick on him. Cause like, and I was a really good horseman, and I did a lot of whip work with horses when I did Liberty stuff. I knew how to use a whip, like, you know what I mean? Like, every whip, every design, every technique, every sensitive way to be with it, just laying it over a horse, using the string on it for something. Like, I was good with whips, but I was like, you just could not even carry a whip on this horse. Like, you couldn't make one mistake. If it accidentally just showed up in front of his eye, he would, like, almost drop you.
Oh, my.
He was almost dangerous, like, with it. And I even took some time to try to teach him, like, oh, well, don't be afraid, but I'm never... And I was like, no way. Okay, just not going to work. I was like,
never mind.
Forget it. Even as good as I was at stuff, it was just never going to work. And so I just didn't carry the stick on him. So he climbed into my heart in a special way. And he was early on in my career, you know, so I got to learn a lot from him. So winning that many races on a horse was, like, a pretty cool thing. And then there was a horse called Royal Mountain Inn that I rode on the turf for Barkley Tag that he had a surgery, and he had screws put in his leg, and I had my surgery and had screws put in my arm, and we won the race that day, and I guess we counted up between the two of us. There was, like, 27 screws and two plates or something.
Wow.
And it was a grade one stake, and so it was kind of cool. But I don't have favorites. I rode Housebuster. I rode, what's the big mare? Safely Kept. I lost them out in the Breeders' Cup on her because I broke my leg. I broke my arm. Housebuster, the same thing. I had an injury. I rode him. I broke his maiden. So I rode a lot of really good horses. So I don't have favorites. It's not my nature. I do with my dogs. I always tell my little white chihuahua that she's my favorite.
Your white chihuahua is your favorite. Well, Julie, just about a minute here left. Really quick question. What advice would you give to a young rider?
Know your horsemanship. It has nothing to do with anything else. If you're good with horses and you're a good horseman and you're a thorough horseman, you're going to be a good jockey. That's plain. It's easy. It's like, look at Rosina Pravnik. Why is she the only other girl to ever do, you know, why did Donna Barton have the success she has? Because she's a thorough horseman. Her mom was a jockey. She was, like, around racing. She, like, studies it, worships it, is part of it, breathes it, lives it, sleeps it. It's a thorough, you have to engulf yourself and be, you have to be a real horseman. Take care of your horsemanship, and your horsemanship will take care of you.
Good answer, Julie. And another quick question for you. Do you still ride?
I do ride occasionally. My horses are in a charity organization called Long Shadow Farm in Greenwich, New York, up above Saratoga, and I ride them sometimes when I go visit. And I rode with my friend Kathy Clark in New Jersey at Beacon Hill Training Center. It was a famous barn in the Animal Planet show, the virtual horse show barn. Bruce Springsteen's daughter rides there, so I rode a couple massive $300,000 beautiful, gorgeous beasts that jump giant fences, and I had a really good time, but I do not ride every day anymore. Just like that boat trip with Sammy that day, there's other things, you know, and I'm having a lot of fun.
Well, Julie, we're all out of time, but thank you so much for taking the time to do this with us and wishing you all of the best.
Thank you.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you are there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, and of course, Express Bet Radio. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.